Well, hello, welcome along to church today, or welcome to those joining with us online. I want to begin with a question, if I may. The question is this: if you got to ask God for one thing, what would you ask him for? So imagine God showed up, as frightening as that is, and he gave you one wish, and you could wish for anything in the world that you wanted. What would you wish for? Well, would you wish for fame, fortune, health, happiness, looks, love? Or maybe you'd wish for something a little more altruistic. You could wish for equality, equity, world peace, end world hunger, justice, or fairness. Now, suffice it to say, whatever we would choose, it would probably be something that we would think would make a big difference to our lives, wouldn't it? So I don't know if you've seen the latest Tim Tam ad. The latest Tim Tam ad has a genie giving a dog three wishes. Wish number one was for the bucket around his head to disappear. Wish number two was for a massive pile of bones to drop in front of him. And wish number three was for a never-ending pack of Tim Tams for his master. Now, why did he wish that? Because he knows that making his master happy is going to make the biggest difference in his life, isn't it? So what do you think would make the biggest difference in your life? One wish. Well, in Exodus chapter 33, Moses makes one wish of God. Now, this wish comes in the context of Moses saying, "Look, I don't know, Lord, if I can actually lead this stiff-necked nation of yours." So what is it that Moses would wish for that would make the biggest difference to his ability to lead the nation of Israel? Well, this is Exodus 33, verse 18. "Then Moses said, 'Now show me your glory.'" Now show me your glory. And in the very next chapter, God tells Moses to climb Mount Sinai, and we're told that God passed in front of Moses. He showed Moses his glory. About 1,000 years after that, the prophet Elijah travels to the exact same mountain and camps out in a cave. But in the Hebrew, it's actually the cave. Right? It's the same cave that Moses stood in when God showed him his glory. Now, Elijah was distraught to the point of death. He said, when he was there, he said, "Look, please just end my life, Lord." And the reason for this distress was because the queen, the evil queen, had just decreed his execution. So what does God give Elijah to help strengthen him to continue to be his prophet? Well, let me read to you two verses. This is 1 Kings 19, verses 11 and 12. "The Lord said, 'Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by.' Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountain apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper." And that gentle whisper was God passing in front of Elijah. So the thing that made the biggest difference in the life of Moses and in the life of Elijah was seeing God's glory. And in our passage today, these two prophets show up again, on a different mountain this time, as Jesus shows his disciples his glory. Now, friends, what we're looking at today is the thing that will make the single biggest difference in the life of a believer. And that thing is the glory of Jesus. Now, I've got 3 points to help us understand this today. 3 points to convince us that if God ever does give us one wish, all right, that wish should be, "Show me your glory." Now, you can see it on the inside of the news sheet. They're very simple points. We're going to begin by seeing the glory of Jesus. That's in verses 1 and 2. We'll then unpack what this means, and I've titled that "Understanding the Glory of Jesus." That's in verses 3 to 7. And we'll then conclude by seeing how the glory of Jesus will make the biggest impact. That is the thing that makes the biggest impact in the life of a believer. And I've titled that "Experiencing the Glory of Jesus." And that's verses 9 to 13. But our goal for today is to see that God is granting us in this passage the thing that will make the greatest impact on our lives as Christians. So let's dive in and look at seeing the glory of Jesus, understanding the glory of Jesus, and experiencing the glory of Jesus. And our passage begins in verse 1 with the words, after 6 days. Now, the interesting thing about this is the only time in all of Matthew's gospel that he mentions the number of days between events. So why is he being so accurate here? Well, he is wanting to show that the transfiguration, that's the passage that was just read for us, occurred within 1 week of Peter's confession. Now, if you remember from last week, all right, Peter's confession is the first big climax in the Gospel of Matthew. It's the thing that the Gospel of Matthew has been moving towards. Right? Who is Jesus? He is the Messiah, the Son of the Living God. Matthew 16:16. And straight after this confession, Jesus shows his disciples his glory. So read with me verse 1 and 2. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Now, Luke's gospel tells us that his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Now here's the thing, have you ever tried to look directly at the sun? Have you ever seen lightning up close? There was a TV ad a few years ago about a guy that just comes bursting out of a bathroom completely blind. Now why is he blind? It's because the bathroom had just been cleaned by this amazing new product and it was so bright and shiny that it blinded anyone who went in here. That's what's going on here. You see, Jesus is not just clothed in white with a warm glow coming from behind him. His face shone like the sun. And his clothes were like lightning. Now, for Old Testament scholars, this reminds us of another mountaintop experience. You see, when God revealed his glory to Moses back in Exodus 34, we are told that Moses' face was radiant. All right, he comes down. I just want to read you just one verse. So as soon as he comes down from the mountain, we read this in Exodus 34, verse 30. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant and they were afraid to come near him. So the transfiguration is another mountaintop experience with another radiant appearance. The big difference, though, between Moses and Jesus is that Moses only reflected the glory of God. He is like the moon, if you will. You see, the moon lights up the night sky with its radiance, doesn't it? But only with light reflected from the sun. So if Moses is the moon, Jesus is the sun. Right? He is the source of this bright radiance. And the whole point of this passage, the reason the transfiguration is in Matthew's gospel, is to show that Jesus is the Son of the Living God. In the very last passage we heard that Jesus is the Son of the Living God. Now, only 6 days later, Jesus shows he radiates the glory of God because he is God. Right? Hebrews 1:3, the Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. So, Jesus is bright and shiny. Right, he's glorious. Now, the question is, so what? I mean, sure, it's a spectacle and all. It would have been great to be there. Maybe a little scary. The disciples were certainly scared. But what difference does that make to me that Jesus is bright and shiny? Well, in verses 3 to 7, Matthew helps us understand the glory of Jesus. Have a look at verses 3 and 4 with me. Just then appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up 3 shelters, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah. Now, what's with the shelters? Well, Luke's account of the transfiguration tells us that Peter didn't actually know what he was saying. Have you ever been in one of those situations where you feel you need to say something, but you don't really know what to say, and then something really stupid comes out? So there's an episode of the TV show The Office. The very awkward Michael meets a very attractive young lady for the first time, and he goes, wow, you're very exotic looking. Was your dad a GI? ridiculously inappropriate, all right? That's kind of what's going on here. Peter doesn't know what to say. So he says, oh, look, if you wish, I'll put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Now, the thing is, Peter's comment here is even more inappropriate than Michael's comment from the office. The reason being that Peter's comment is suggesting that Jesus is just like Moses and Elijah, all right? Let's put up three shelters. We've got here the Hall of Fame for the nation of Israel. We've got Jesus and Moses and Elijah. Let's look after you guys. See, what Peter is failing to realize is that Jesus is nothing like Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah can only ever reflect the glory of God. Jesus is the source of the glory of God. And what that means is you do not treat Jesus just like you treat his prophets. You treat Jesus as God. And to show Peter how wrong he is here, God the Father actually interrupts Peter to tell him this. So have a look at verse 5. While he was still speaking, while Peter was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son whom I love, with him I am well pleased. Listen to him." So God the Father, he repeats the exact same message he spoke at Jesus' baptism with one addition, all right? Listen to him. Whatever my son says, you are to believe. Whatever my son commands, you are to follow. Right? Your life is to be shaped by my son. And herein lies the reason for the transfiguration. Right? If you're asking yourself, so what? What does this mean to us? Why is this in the Bible? It is in the Bible because Jesus' glory is supposed to impact, is supposed to transform our whole lives. Let me explain. The word glory actually means significance or weight. Right, so keep that in mind, significance or weight. In Tolkien's book The Hobbit, the dwarves escape the woodland elves by hiding in huge wine barrels that are then sent down the river. Now those barrels, however, are at the mercy of the river. Why are they at the mercy of the river? It is because the water in that river is more significant, it has more weight than the barrels, even with little hobbits in them, or dwarves, I should say. But here's the thing. If you drop an enormous boulder in the middle of that river, it is not carried along by the water, is it? In fact, the water has to move around the boulder. The reason being that the boulder has more significance, more weight, more glory than the river does, than the water. Now, the reason Jesus shows his disciples his glory is to show that he is God. And as God, he is the most significant being in existence alongside the Father and the Spirit. And as such, our whole lives are to be affected by that. We are to be carried along. We are but passengers like those dwarves in the barrels. Right? Jesus' glory is to move us just like that. But of course, Jesus is not some raging river that is going to smash us to pieces by throwing us off a 500-meter high waterfall. Right? Jesus is a perfectly righteous, good, kind, and holy God. And he uses his weight, his significance, his glory for our good. He doesn't want to smash us. He wants to transform us into the most beautiful, stable, moral, successful, merciful, kind, generous, and grace-filled people on the planet. That's how he uses his glory, his significance. And that's the point of this passage. Right? Jesus shows us his glory so that we will be transformed into the greatest Christians we can be. Just like God's glory transformed Moses and Elijah into the two greatest figures in the Old Testament. The question is, how well is this working for us. Is Jesus' glory really impacting us? So what I mean is this. How many of us still get crushed by criticism, don't we? Many of us still get anxious. Many of us still have those secret addictive habits. Many of us still feel we need to prove ourselves to those around us. Many of us have to check our notifications immediately to see who loves us. Many of us still get irritable, and many of us still get harsh with others if they are not living up to our very high standards. Now, the reason for this is that we might understand the glory of Jesus intellectually, but we don't yet know it experientially. All right, we know intellectually that Jesus' view of us is supposed to outweigh our parents' view of us, or our boss's view of us, or our friend's view of us, or social media's view of us, but it doesn't. Okay? The reason many of us work too hard, the reason many of us check our post 10 times a day to see if we've got any more likes, the reason many of us are devastated by rejection is because the praises of men are more significant, more weighty, more glorious to us than the praises of God. So the real question this passage asks is, how can the glory of Jesus impact us if we weren't there to actually experience it with Peter, James, and John? You see, the reason Moses and Elijah were the two greatest figures of the Old Testament, all right, the ones that showed up on the Mount of Transfiguration, is because they experienced the glory of God. The reason Peter and John, now James was killed very early on in the early church, but the reason Peter and John went on to become the two greatest New Testament figures alongside the Apostle Paul, and the Apostle Paul got not one but two experiences of God's glory, the reason those three were the most significant people in the New Testament is because they got to experience the glory of Jesus. So how do we everyday Christians, you and me Christians, experience the glory of Jesus without seeing that terrifying, brilliant light? Well, it's by understanding that our glory impacted Jesus. Let me explain. Directly following the Transfiguration, Jesus makes his second passion prediction. Have a look at verse 9. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Now, last time Jesus mentioned his death, poor Peter received the rebuke of rebukes, didn't he? "Get behind me, Satan." This time, they tread a little more carefully. Have a look at verse 10. The disciples asked him, so this is straight after he says this, the disciples asked him, "Why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Now, this question seems way out of left field. Why is he asking this question? Well, it seems out of left field until we understand what they're actually asking. You see, the disciples have just seen Elijah in real life, haven't they? And as good Jews would know, the Old Testament closes with a promise of the return of Elijah. So let me read to you the last two verses of the Old Testament. All right, this is Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. It says, "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the father to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers." So the Old Testament prophesied that Elijah would return to prepare the way for the Lord, and the Lord would then make all things right. And what the disciples are asking in verse 10 is, well, we've just seen Elijah, and that means that you are the Messiah, the Lord, but here's the question, how are you going to make all things right if you're dead? It's a good question, isn't it? And Jesus says, look, Elijah does come first. John the Baptist was the one who turned the hearts of the fathers to their children. But the way I'm going to make all things right is through suffering and death. Now, friends, do you understand what the cross is? See, the cross is Jesus looking upon us insignificant little barrels as we are being carried along by the torrent that is sin. And that torrent is carrying us towards a 500-foot cliff, a waterfall that is going to smash us to pieces, called hell. Yet Jesus says, "You are not insignificant to me. So weighty, so glorious are you to me that I'm going to change the trajectory of my life. I am going to jump into the torrent of sin and throw you to safety, even though I know it will mean that I will have to go off that cliff." See, the cross is allowing our insignificant little glory to impact, to move him, even though he knew it would take him over the waterfall. Now, friends, when this starts to become real to our hearts, all right, when that head knowledge starts to touch our hearts, do you know what happens? Everything is affected. We no longer get crushed by criticism. We know we're sinful. Nothing short of the death of the Son of God could actually atone for our sin. But even if they're right in their criticism, and chances are they are right, I know I am loved and accepted by someone infinitely more important than that person. We no longer get as anxious. All right, if Jesus was enveloped by darkness so that you and I could be enveloped by God's light and glory, then I know he's looking out for me. No matter how dark my days might look. We no longer need our addictions to get through the day, right? We've got something infinitely more enjoyable, infinitely more valuable to us in Jesus. We no longer have to check our notifications immediately to see if someone loves me. I mean, it's nice if someone loves me, but man, their love of me is infinitesimal in importance compared to knowing I'm loved by Jesus. We no longer get irritable when our kid gets out of bed for the 40th time, because we know that whatever someone does to irritate us, Jesus has forgiven us a million times more. And we no longer get harsh. We treat people with mercy. Jesus treated us a million times better than we deserve. And so we show that same mercy to those who cannot live lives as holy as we might be able to. Friends, the thing that will impact our lives the most, the thing that will make a bigger difference in our lives as Christians than anything else, is experiencing the glory of Jesus. So as we close, here's our application for today. 2 points. Number one, look for the glory of Jesus. Scour the scriptures every day, searching for the glory of Jesus. Right? Reading the Bible is not some religious duty that we have to do. That's not why I harp on and on about it like a broken record. The reason I am so strong on this is because the Bible is where we find the glory of Jesus, which will impact us more than anything else in life. So point one, look for the glory of Jesus each and every day. Step two, pray that God will show you his glory in the Word. Right? Moses' one wish of God was, "Show me your glory." That is my first prayer every day. I'm not joking. Whenever I start my prayers, it starts with this one prayer. Lord God, show me your glory. The beauty of this passage is that we don't actually have to wait for God to show up and grant us our one wish. He's already given us all we need to see the glory of Jesus. He's given us his Word and he's given us his Spirit. Now what that means is, if God ever does show up one day, we can ask for a never-ending pack of Tim Tams. Why? Because we've already got the very thing that will impact us more than anything else. So friends, may we be scouring the scriptures every day, eagerly looking for the glory of Jesus, and as we do, asking God, "Show me your glory."